golf course architect Brian Silva on what makes a great course.
This is Golf Smarter. Each week, we tap the minds of PGA and USGA course pros, architects, authors, and teaching gurus to provide you with tips, drills, insights, and advice so that you can lower your scores. Golf Smarter is brought to you by Edwin Watts Golf, golf's most trusted retailer since 1968. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome, and thanks for joining us for another Golf Smarter podcast, and Happy New Year to you. Our podcast is brought to you in part by Bird Golf Academy. If you're looking for the ultimate golf learning experience, check into the Bird Golf Academy. They have schools all over the United States. So for more, go to golfsmarterpodcast.com and click on the link to Bird Golf Academy. Before we go on, here's some good news I wanted to share with you. Billy Bondurek, who introduced us to the seven myths of golf, was just named the Northern California PGA Teacher of the Year. Now, we're hoping to get Billy back on the show to continue with his seven myths of golf. But if you've not heard our conversation with him previously, please go back and check it out. It was published on August 16th, 2006. Congratulations, Billy. And our guest today is Brian Silva, a golf course architect. This interview was recorded a week or so ago, so I wanted to clarify something before you hear the interview. At one point, he talks about Redan features. Being that I'd never heard that term before, I thought he was talking about Rodin sculptures being on a golf course. Duh, nice way to show how stupid you are, Fred. Anyway, Brian sent me an article that he published in Links Magazine that explains a Redan feature. And he wrote this, and it says that while the word itself was coined to describe the 15th hole at North Berwick, Redan has come to mean a specific manner of green complex. Now, you take a narrow tableland, tilt it a little from right to left, dig a deep bunker on the front side, approach it diagonally, and you have a Redan. Picture that one in your mind, how you've seen greens that have that look. This type of turn encourages players to bump and run their approach shots into the embankment and onto the green. Hopefully this will help you understand that aspect of the conversation, which I found to be quite enlightening. Longtime listeners will know that I really believe you can lower your scores by understanding how to read the features of a course. Brian's quite articulate and passionate about golf course architecture and how it comes to help us play better. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks, Fred.
How are you?
I'm just great.
Do you specialize in new design or redesign?
I could either say I specialize in both or neither. I do a lot of work in both directions.
Which do you prefer?
I think they both have their charms. There's probably something special about a new design from scratch, kind of the expressive aspect of that. But this past summer, I worked in restoring the Country Club of Charleston, a Rainer course in South Carolina, and it would be really an oversight on my part if I didn't say working in that kind of a situation wasn't a special one as well. I think they all have their interesting aspects.
And what are you working on currently?
Well, we've got a shutdown renovation at the Riverside course at Greenville Country Club in South Carolina. It started this past Monday. January 2nd, Annandale Golf Club in Pasadena, California, is shutting down for a wall-to-wall renovation. I have a 18-hole course in Wells, Maine, southern Maine, that's clearing right now. And, Fred, I first walked that site in 1986.
And now you're getting around to doing the job?
Yeah, and it's on its fourth owner. You know, golf course architects can be famous or infamous, whichever one you want to choose, for, you know, going through any number of clients during a job, and usually the reasons are financial. Well, I've kind of set a personal record here. It's the fourth owner, and we're finally just starting construction.
Oh, my goodness. And at times you're just so frustrated, you're like, you know, I don't even want to deal with this job.
Well, you know, you just, there always seems to be something on your plate. And I think you can almost look at it the other way. When they come back to life, they're really a pleasant surprise. You know, you think they're gone forever, but you find out that's not the case. Mm. And then in the spring, we're going to be renovating the Ross course at the Mount Washington Hotel, which will be a really, really interesting project.
And so you're saying the Donald Ross course?
Yes, yes, I am.
So how does that feel to go to a design legend and have to rework what he's done?
Well,
is that intimidating?
No, I don't. I wouldn't call it intimidating. I've done, you know, starting at a place like Seminole or Biltmore Forest in North Carolina. I've been fortunate enough to do quite a few of them, and I don't want to say the wrong thing, but you see works of different levels when you do it. Perhaps the Mount Washington course has been changed a lot over time, or perhaps it never got the full dose when it was originally done, but it's not tremendously recognizable as a Ross course now.
Okay, so I'm reading between the lines here a little bit, and tell me if I'm wrong. You don't think this is one of Donald Ross's better courses, do you?
Well, I think it's probably suffered over the years. You know, each course.
So polite.
No, but I think that's really the case. You know, Fred, in the past 15 or 20 years, there's been a real reawakening and a reappreciation of the original works of these fellas. You know, some of these courses suffered in the Depression when bunkers were filled in, and they suffered during the 50s and 60s when it was kind of it was kind of like housing or building design. These flat roofed buildings and the prairie style came in, and everybody turned away from federal and colonial styles. And today, they're all going back to these federal and colonial styles. Well, golf is really not any different than that. They had their, I'll call them federal and colonial styles, and they put aluminum siding on them and changed the roof lines. And then they came to realize in the past 15 or 20 years, hey, we had something special. Let's get rid of that aluminum siding, and let's put our gambrel roofs back on and put our clapboards back on and champion what we originally had. So I think that's what a lot of these older course projects, I think that's how they're framed, rather than, well, the course wasn't very good at once. There's a chance the course was very good, but it's just been changed dramatically over time. And a lot of times, the people don't even realize it's been changed because it's been changed over 70 years, and they took out a couple bunkers one year and then took out a few more bunkers another year, and then they had a green they thought was kind of weird. It was kind of like a punch bowl, and it didn't drain as well as they could, so they took out that unique feature. And over decades and decades, they went from the most unique features on a list, taken one out every few years, and pretty soon they didn't have any unique features left at all. And each course became kind of like every other course, and every slice bunker was a set distance from a tee, and every hook bunker was a set distance from a tee, and courses became homogenized. And I think over the past 15 or 20 years, people have realized they had something unique that may have been deteriorated over the years, and they want to go back to something more like their original.
And that's a positive thing.
I think it's a very positive thing because
you go across the country and everything is homogenized in the sense of you can go to any mall in the country, you can eat at any McDonald's, go to any Starbucks, and it's exactly the same as you have in your backyard. But for a golf course, you don't want to go to a course and go, this is just like my course at home.
Well, see, that's a change in thinking today, Fred. I think for a long time, it was just the opposite that damaged some of these older courses, because someone would go play another course in that 50s or 60s style and said, that course had all its fairway bunkers parallel to the line of play. They were lateral bunkers in the rough. They didn't have any of these funny old bunkers like ours that were perpendicular to the shot and stuck into play. And, oh, boy, the corridors were nice and narrow. just like a U.S. Open course, and you really had to hit it down the middle. And I think there was actually, I sometimes call it an unconscious effort, but I think it was a subconscious, that's kind of, there's one of my great faux pas. I think it was an unconscious effort, but it was subconscious to actually make every course like every other course in the country. And I think today people have realized that that's something they shouldn't do. They would never do that with their clubhouse. You know, walking up the 18th hole, looking at all the windows in the back facade of a clubhouse, someone would never say, hey, that third window from the right, nobody ever is in that room. It's just a storage room, and nobody looks out that window. Let's cover over that window with plywood. No one ever uses it. But they would say, you know, we should fill in that bunker on the third hole. It's too short off the tee, and no one ever hits into it. Let's fill it in. They would do that willingly, but they would never do that to the clubhouse, because if you suggested they do it to the clubhouse, they would say to you, are you nuts? That's part of the fabric of the clubhouse.
Yeah.
It's part of the thing that makes our clubhouse unique and makes our clubhouse different from every other one. Why would we ever want to put plywood over that window? But in the next breath, they would talk about filling in that bunker on the third hole. It's an interesting contradiction.
Yeah, very, very interesting. So let's talk about design strategy and how your philosophies on how you design for strategy in play.
Well, Fred, I think really there's nothing new in design. And I think when you look back at some of the early American golf courses and courses on the links of Scotland, as they were originally, before they got homogenized, especially in the States, you see golf courses that had pretty wide corridors of play, and you see golf courses that had bunkers not at cookie-cutter distances from tees, and they were sprinkled throughout the landscape. I call them random bunkers, and I don't mean to suggest they were put in randomly. They were put in with thought, but they made for an interesting route from the tee to the green. And it wasn't always a straight route. Sometimes you had to work your way around the bunkers. You kind of had to tack your way around the bunkers as if you were sailing. But what those wide corridors and those more random hazards did was they set up delightfully interesting alternative routes of play, truly strategic design. And when a person stood on a tee, they were intrigued. They were enthused by what they saw. They realized they had to plot their course a little bit as they stood on the tee. It was not just that mind-numbingly boring thing of standing on the tee and saying, I have to thread this right down the middle to keep it out of the trees to the left of this narrow corridor of play and keep it out of the trees on this right narrow corridor of play. They could look through the green and they could see that maybe that green pointed back to the right-hand side of the fairway so that a shot down the right side of the hole that maybe challenged a bunker was the route that you should take to make your next shot easier. You know, Hogan said, golf is a game that's best played if you think one shot ahead. And I think he was referring to great strategic golf courses when he made that comment. So I very much look to the early designs and some of the vintage architecture to see the real kind of treatise on strategy. And I think, you know, reviewing a course like the National Golf Links is just the greatest primer on strategy. There are all kinds of alternate routes. There are bunkers that are right in your face off the tee, and they make you make decisions. Am I going to fly this bunker? Am I going to go to the left of the bunker? Am I going to go to the right of the bunker? They're fascinating courses.
Do you think that design today, because there are so many players today, and we're not talking about tour players, we're talking about guys, you know, mid-level handicappers, that with so many people out there, so many people playing, resort courses popping up every 5 minutes, do you think that strategy is being taken out of design so that we can get more people to be comfortable on a golf course? Or do you think more strategy is being put in to challenge more players?
No, I think, sadly, that that incorrectly there's a pressure to dummy down design to make a course more playable. And I don't think that that's at all appropriate, and I don't think it's necessary. You can still have strategy, and you can still have a very healthy number of bunkers so long as you have, the tire commercial says it right, wider is better. As long as you have routes around the hazards, this line of charm thing is really very, very key. You know, players want to take the straight line from tee to green, but if you put a hazard in that, you know, they find that line of charm. I really think on daily fee courses and some resort courses, a strategy in design is relegated to second or third place, and I'm not sure that's necessary.
What's your favorite strategic design element?
I would say it's hazards on the diagonal or on angles that allow players of varying capabilities to bite off what they dare or hit as risky a shot as they dare, whether it's a bunker on a diagonal or a green complex that doesn't exactly point right down the fairway. It's canted a little bit to the left or canted a little bit to the right or canted more than a little bit to the left or right. I think angles in design are really what give a course its thought-provoking characteristic and nature, and lets a player like me play out to the right to the safe part of a green, and lets a better player say, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go right at the pin.
So you are a player.
You know, when you say a player, that's sometimes suggests, wow, that guy's a player.
Okay. So you play golf.
Oh, yeah.
You're a golfer.
I would be, I don't know how you can have a real feel for this without playing. I sometimes hear you have to be a 2-handicapper, and I'm not sure that's the case, but my game and what I do really lets me plot my way both through my designs and my rounds of golf.
Very interesting. So it leads me to my next question, which is, what kind of pet peeves do you have when you're on golf courses that you didn't design or courses that you're going to redesign that have been incorporated that as a golfer you look at and go, that's ridiculous?
Well, could I add another category?
Oh, please.
How about courses I have designed. You know, that's one thing about the craft. When a university professor develops a new grass, say for greens or bunkers, he puts it out in these test plots. And for every grass that he selects, there might be 5 or 10 or a dozen that he rejects. Golf architects don't really have that luxury. They do their evolving of their craft right in front of everyone's eyes. And I think that the things that I've grown a little less fond of are fairway bunkers at standard distances from tees.
What do you mean by standard distance?
Oh, I mean you can pick up some publications that say that slice bunkers should be 285 yards from the tee, and hook bunkers should be 310 yards from the tee, and there shouldn't be any bunkers in the more moderate length players' landing areas, things like that. I think that I just find that the lost opportunities on courses to inject a strategy and angles and keep each hole fresh and interesting for the average player, I think those aspects are disappointing because it leads to such a huge percentage of players that don't think their way around a golf course and don't stand on a tee and say, now, let me try to think, what is the architect trying to suggest that I do, or what routes is he suggesting that a player of my ability take? I think that sometimes we don't do a good job educating the golfers. They know what waterfall looks nice, and they know what grass looks like. It's 12 on a scale of 1 to 10 being green. I just wish that we expose them more frequently to interesting design and thoughtful design and strategic design and design with angles that would help them be better players and would help them lower their handicap. Because, you know, I'll play with some friends and we'll be on a golf hole and two of the guys in my group, you know, they push the ball or hit fade and they go out and they stand on the middle of the tee to hit their shots and they aim them down the middle of the fairway. They're doomed to failure. And no one has ever said to them, look, with your shot shape, you should go to the right-hand side of the tee and aim a little bit down the left-hand side of the fairway and use the entire corridor. And I think things like that, because they've never been required to think as much as they should off the tee and in other parts of their game, I wish we did a better job of educating the golfer in that regard.
I would love to say that strategy is a lost art, but I don't even know if it was found in the first place. I just think that for us on the Golf Smarter podcast, that we try to talk about and emphasize strategy and try to figure out how to look at the features of a course and learn how to read them so you can become a better player. And based on the feedback that I get from listeners, it works. They are saying, I'm playing better, I'm playing smarter. Why is it that it's such an unsexy topic to print and Golf Channel and these places that they don't discuss strategy?
Well, because it's more fun to just show a picture of a bunker with, you know, hay growing on the back of it, or it's more fun to show this new picture of a golf course out in the desert with a waterfall. That seems to capture people's imagination more. Now that, you know, Fred, you just told me that people have responded well to your talking about strategy, I'm going to take that as a reason to go on.
Okay.
Because sometimes you think that that is secondary. It seems at times today that it's the wrapping on the package that is more important to the vast majority of players than actually what's in the package. And that's quite backwards, because the wrapping on the package, how nice the grass is, how white the sand is in the bunkers, whether the bunker has one nose or two noses or three noses, those are really superficial things that can be changed quite easily. But if you haven't worked the right strategy into a golf hole originally, very often it's impossible to get it in at a later time. And you find a little bit of the same thing that I think of sometimes, is that how can we make that a more interesting aspect? I talked to Ron Witten of Golf Digest about that a lot, and Ron's very interested in that stuff, but they find that their readers just are not interested in strategy. They want to hear that the rocks that lined the pond were spray-painted to look like the mountains in the backdrop.
They want a cure for their slice.
Yeah.
I mean, if that's what the cover every month says,
yep,
we'll cure your slice.
Yeah. And, you know, people have talked about what an architect's job is. You know, William Flynn said something to the effect that the architect should never lose sight of his role as an educational factor of the game. And I think sometimes we don't think of it that way. You know, we just we we need to just give our work a little bit more thought, I think. I'm not one to tell the group what to do, but I think, again, like we mentioned before, design has been standardized for the reasons you suggested. There's so many players, and it's been maybe watered down a little bit, and I just don't think that needs to be done.
Do you think that a lot of design is going on so they can get in the list of the hottest, top 50, the best resort? Do you think design is done for media attention?
Oh, well, I think a lot. I don't see how it can't be, because a lot of clients want that.
Well, then, actually, I wrote that question down. How often do you find that you're caught between designing for a golfer and designing for the owner? Or are you even caught? I mean, it's the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules.
Well, I really think that there is pressure in that regard, but I don't know why. I find I've been fortunate. In a lot of my new work, especially, the clients give me some general guidance, and then feel that I will interpret what they've said and respond with something on the ground. And so I have to say, I don't get a lot of, I want a hard course. I don't get a lot of, I want an easy course. I get a lot of, I want a good course. I want a course that isn't like every other golf course. I want some interesting features out there. But Brian, I only want 7 Redans on my course, not any more than that.
But when they say I want an interesting feature, does that mean they want a Rodin, or they want a water sculpture, or do they want a golf feature?
I think what they're looking for, Fred, is they're just looking for a course that doesn't look like every other golf course.
More power to them.
And now there's 2 ways to respond to that. One way is to take every mound on the edge of the fairway that used to be 4 feet and make it 12 feet. Hmm. Or one way is to make a stream that has 1 waterfall have 7 waterfalls in its length. But I think there's another way that's more basic, and that's to harken back to strategy, angles in play, random hazards. Because a player like me who stands too close to the ball after I hit it, when I go play one of these standardized courses...
I'm sorry, I just got it. Okay, go ahead.
I never fly a fairway bunker. Hmm. They never come into play for me when they're 285 yards off the tee on the slice side and 305 or 310 on the hook side. But when I go to one of these crazy, more old-fashioned courses, excuse me for saying this, that I do, and there's a fairway bunker out that sticks out into the fairway that's perpendicular to the shot, and it sticks out the fairway maybe 170. Now, there's 40 yards of fairway to the left of it. I can completely miss that bunker if I want. I can go around it. But I know sometimes that the best route to the green is over the bunker. I can actually fly a fairway bunker. And when you think of it, it's a thrill that a player of my ability is rarely given the opportunity to achieve. And that's what I mean by this watering down or dummying down. I don't think that's right. I think that a player of my ability, an average player, should be able to fly a bunker like Tiger Woods does. Like Tiger rips at it, and you hear him and Steve saying, go, go, to fly the bunker. I want to have that thrill sometimes.
Absolutely.
And I want the average player to have that thrill sometimes.
We thank you.
And when they play these courses with strictly lateral bunkers at set distances from tees, they never, ever, ever get that opportunity. And I think that's sad, because I think the shot that I just described is what this game, golf, is all about. If there's other games you can play, Fred, that have lateral hazards, and everything is out in front of you from the tee, and one of them's called bowling. And it's a great game, because you can play it 365 days a year inside, and you know what? When you lose the ball, it comes right back to you. But that's not golf.
No.
That's an aberrant form, and I like you, you find that your listeners respond well to it, and I think you're seeing part of the craft go back to these older style courses, and that's awesome.
You know, there's always the discussion of pace of play, cost.
Fred, those are specious discussions, if you'll forgive me for saying that. You could take out every bunker on every course in America, and the amount of time it takes to play golf would not go down by a minute.
So what do you think is the biggest problem facing the golf industry today, from your perspective?
Oh, I think it's reasonably priced facilities. The trouble today is, I'm from New Hampshire. I work in the Massachusetts area. To come up with a parcel of land that's 200 acres or more in size is a pretty expensive thing. And then to build a course today, the first course I built, the Captains on Cape Cod, was built for $900,000. We'll still put a course in the ground for, you know, between $2 and $3 million. But when you put the land cost together with that construction cost, and there's a maintenance building and maintenance equipment and a functional clubhouse, you can't charge $25. And I think that's a real problem facing the game. I don't think it's the speed of play. You know, we'll be working on a project, and we'll have roughed in a bunker, and someone will say, you can't put a bunker there. It's going to slow down play. And I always wonder, well, what do you mean it'll slow down play? If the ball went into the rough, it would be harder for me to find the ball than when it's in the bunker. And when I go into a bunker, you know, I kind of dig in my feet, I swing, and I hit the ball. So when they say it's going to slow down play, I say, yes, you're right, it's going to slow down play 15 seconds. I think the speed of play thing has been a really specious reason for emasculating thousands of golf courses in the country. I really don't think bunkers slow down play as much as they're given credit for. Whenever someone says to me, that's a safety problem, or it slows down play, I very often think they don't have a good reason for being against doing it, and they're just falling down. They're falling back to those two red flags that have very little basis in fact. Next time you play, Fred, I want you to think how much time was truly added to your round when you had to hit shots out of bunkers, and I bet you it's dramatically less than 5 minutes.
To me, from my observation, the thing that I find that slows down the pace of play more than anything is trying to find the yardage markers to see exactly how far it is.
Yeah.
Walking all over. Also, excuse me, cart path only slows down the pace of play, especially if you're not playing cart path golf. If you're hitting it on the opposite side and you're sharing with a cart with a guy and he's hitting on one side of the fairway and you're hitting on the other, and you got to walk around and try to figure out how far you got to hit the next shot. So you got to find the yardage marker, and you can't find the yardage. To me, that slows down the pace of play.
Well, it's really an interesting thing. Just think of all the things we've done in the past, how many years, 40 or 50 years. We've taken out thousands upon thousands of bunkers from old courses. We've also limited the number of bunkers we put on new courses. We've made them lateral bunkers, and we've pushed them so far out that players can't get to them until the average player can't get to them till their second or third shot. We've got 150-yard markers, 200-yard markers, 100-yard markers. We've got posts on the sides of the fairways, markers on every single sprinkler head on the golf course. We got markers on the cart path. Has the speed of play gone down? No, it hasn't. Really, none of those things have helped the speed of play.
So what's slowing it down?
We're Americans.
Keep going.
Go to Scotland. You'll play a round of golf in 3 hours.
So
you move right along.
Explain your answer about we're Americans. What do you mean by that?
I think we play more slowly. We watch golf on TV. We see the players put the peg in the ground. and then we get behind the ball and we take a couple practice swings as we visualize the flight of the ball. And then we step up to the ball and we do our swing checks and we do our 15 waggles, and then we proceed to top it somewhere up by the forward tee. You wouldn't think that you really had to take that much time to visualize that shot. I just think we have a certain pace of play that we play a golf course. And, you know, people will come back from Scotland and they'll say, it's great, I played golf in 3 hours. But again, we have all these distance aids. We've emasculated the hazards on our golf courses, and the speed of play has not been positively impacted at all. It's kind of a remarkable thing.
This is a remarkable interview. Thank you so much for your time, Brian.
It's my pleasure.
I really enjoyed speaking to you, and your insights were incredibly valuable, I think.
Well, I'm not so sure of that, but I appreciate you saying that, Fred.
It's time to ask Kenny. Do you have a question about specific golf gear or baffled about what to look for in a category of golf products? Kenny Nicholson, sales manager at edwinwadsgolf.com, would like to help. And if we use your question on the show, you'll receive a free Golf Smarter Edwin Watts Golf hat. To submit your question, send an email to fred@golfsmarterpodcast.com with the subject, Ask Kenny. Ask Kenny is brought to you by Edwin Watts Golf and edwinwattsgolf.com, golf's most trusted retailer since 1968. Hey, Kenny!
Hey, Fred. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, buddy. Got a question here from Tim Stanley in Edmond, Oklahoma, who rightfully so is saying, with the end of the 2006 season finally here, many will get new clubs, and some will trade their old sticks in for the latest technology. As someone who tries to keep the equipment budget down to raise the playing budget, I often look at the various pre-owned sections, like the ones at Edwin Watts Golf, for great deals. He actually said the Edwin Watts Golf. I didn't make that up. What are the benefits or hazards of buying pre-owned or used clubs?
I think the biggest thing you need to be concerned about is clones or clubs that are obviously have the name, but they're not exactly the clubs. It might say Callaway, Nike, or whatever, and it'd actually be a gimmick type club. Obviously, if you shop at EdwinWattsGolf.com, on our pre-owned section, everything is going to be made from the manufacturer, so you're getting the real deal. And it's a huge benefit in a sense that golf clubs, like cars or anything else, have what I call an over-the-curb reduction. When you drive a car off the car lot, obviously you're going to lose some money. It's going to depreciate a certain value. We have a huge selection of golf clubs that look just like brand new, have been hit just a few times, that sell for considerably less than a brand new price. And as far as playability-wise, are still great golf clubs to get and still offer the manufacturer's warranty with them as well. So, an example, there are especially drivers. We have just a huge quantity of drivers that people have got. We've gotten through trade-ins, things of that nature that we sell all the time. I got an email from one of our customers today talking about, hey, I got a driver through your pre-owned selection the other day, and it's listed as in good condition. When I got the club was like brand new. I just want to tell you thank you very much, and I really enjoyed my shopping experience.
Oh,
we'll
that's
be back.
Nice.
So, yeah, things like that. There's a lot of advantages to buying pre-owned for somebody that wants to save some money. Some people just want to get a brand new club, just like some want to get a brand new car or anything else. They like to be the first one to try it. But the products that we sell are definitely good products. We inspect them when we get them in here. If they need a new grip or anything like that, we take care of that for you. Some products are listed as fair, which means there might be a little bit of a blemish on them or what have you, but as far as playability standpoint, you're not going to see a difference over a brand new club as well.
And as long as you can get yourself fitted and know what you're looking for, does that have any impact on buying used clubs?
It does. A lot of people know exactly what they need in a golf club, and we have such a huge selection of pre-owned products that in drivers, we have a plethora of shafts available, shaft lengths, lofts, left-handed, right-handed, and the same with iron, steel, graphite, stiff, regular, left-hand, right-hand. just about anything that, you know, any golfer is looking for is available through our pre-owned selection. You know, it's that person, though, that might need to know what they're looking for, you know, to go on there and be able to shop with a little bit of knowledge. If you need some help there, you can obviously call one of our sales professionals, and they'll be able to help you in that sense.
Great. Well, Tim, thanks for the question. We'll be sending you out an Edwin Watts Golf Smarter hat. And let's also remind people that we're doing a giveaway, speaking of irons, of some brand new irons, the Tour Edge QL irons. It's a 3-7 hybrid, and an 8-9 and pitching wedge are the standard irons, worth $600.
You know, with the 3-7 being a hybrid type, he offers a very low center of gravity to help get the ball airborne. I consider it almost cheating. It's so easy to hit. So,
And you'll customize that for anybody, whether it's right or left-handed or men's or women, that kind of thing?
Yeah, regular flex, stiff leg, doesn't matter. We'll be able to take care of that for you.
All right. Well, to win the Tour Edge QL irons, send an email with the subject Tour Edge, T-O-U-R, Tour Edge, to pickme@golfsmarterpodcast.com. And along with your email address, please include your name and shipping address so that we know where to send the prize once you win. For more information, check the show notes. And we mislabeled this last week in saying that the drawing will be held on January 9th. Actually, the drawing's going to be held on January 16th. So the deadline for entries is midnight January 15th. Again, the winner will be announced on January 16th. And because it went so well, we're going to continue our December shopping special, which is 10% off of any purchase. Of course, some restrictions apply. So go to golfsmarterpodcast.com, click on the link to Edwin Watts Golf, and it'll take you directly to the Golf Smarter page with full instructions on how to get your 10% off your purchases, and of course, with any purchase, free shipping. Kenny, thanks so much for your time. We'll talk to you next week.
You too, Fred. Take care.
And we end with our quote of the week, which, thank you so much for helping, is submitted by you. Brad Frey of Crystal Lake, Illinois, wrote in this week's quote, he's the high school golf coach for both the boys and the girls team. More power to you, buddy. That's really good. And he says that, surprisingly enough, there are members of his golf team that listen to the Golf Smarter podcast. Go team! Woohoo, Crystal Lake! I don't know what our colors are, but we're cheering for you. One of Brad's favorite golf quotes comes from PGA Touring pro Craig Stadler, and the quote actually reminds him of a time when he might have been a little less mature on the golf course, maybe like some of the kids on his team. Once a reporter asked Craig about his change of clubs, his response was, quote, "Why am I using a new putter? Because the last one didn't float too well." Questions, comments, or suggestions? Please send me an email to fred@golfsmarterpodcast.com.